Did you know there's an online cannabis company that ships federally legal THC right to your door? And they found a way to combine THC with carefully selected functional ingredients to create gummies, baked goods, and flower for whatever type of buzz you'd want. I'm talking about Mood.com. They have an incredible line of cannabis gummies, and you get 20% off your first order at Mood.com with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. This isn't some rinky-dink discount of 5 or 10%. This is 20% off your first order. Forget one-size-fits-all supplements that only get you high. Mood's functional gummies are optimized to kick in as little as 15 minutes and take you to the mood you're looking for. My favorite are the Sleepy Time Advanced gummies. That's right, those are for sleepy time. You know when you just can't fall asleep? Take these and they'll put you right in the mood. Beyond gummies, Mood also has a selection of flower, pre-rolls, bakery treats, and beverages. Listen, you can find gummies to just get you high pretty much everywhere these days. But Mood's functional gummies combine premium, federally legal THC with targeted botanicals to help you get into the perfect mood, usually in as little as 15 minutes. And everything ships discreetly right to your door. No dispensary lines, no awkward conversations, just better days and nights delivered to your doorstep. Best of all, not only is every Mood product backed by a 100-day satisfaction guarantee, but as I mentioned, listeners get 20% off their first order with promo code SPECIALISTS with an S on the end. So head to Mood.com, find the functional gummy that matches exactly what you're looking for, and let Mood help you discover your perfect mood. And don't forget to use promo code SPECIALISTS when you check out to save 20% on your first order. Try it today at mood.com.
Movie Buff Specialist Phil and John are back in a very quick turnaround here. We were expecting to do this later tonight and pretty much 5 minutes ago. I said, John, let's go. And John was like, okay. And here we are. So there was really no prep, at least for doing this at 5:43 in the PM here on the East Coast. But yes, we are talking today about our 52nd favorite movies of all time, the 49th episode, which means next week's will be the midway point. How crazy is that, that we will be celebrating episode number 50 next week? We're ending a long run of not my movies here. In fact, in the last 10 movies that we have discussed, five of them have not actually been in my top 100. So at least five of the movies. I know we talked last week how what was the movie? Parasite was in my top 100. But still, it wasn't talked about when I wanted to talk about it. So I've had to come up with five alternatives. So tonight we're going to be talking about Drive, replacing The Social Network, which I will say The Social Network, one of the hardest movies to find a comp to. Really, really difficult, which I guess speaks to the greatness of that movie. And John's number 52 is Hero, which is a one of a kind here on this list. That's for sure. I don't think we have any other martial arts movies. A good movie if you like the genre. If you don't, then you were probably like me going, oh yikes. But we have two movies here that one has Ryan Gosling and the other is Jet Li, two very popular people. And we're gonna start though. I think we're gonna start with Hero on this one, John, just because I think Hero is definitely one of those movies that since it came out has probably taken a bit of a tumble in terms of viewership. I don't feel like as many people are looking at this nowadays as we're looking at it in 2002. This was obviously coming off All the Rage, which was Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which came out just 2 years before, pretty much made Jet Li a star. But you're going to be able to say a lot more about this movie than I am, because I am going to have a hard time saying anything about this movie.
Yeah, I mean, Hero is, it is the only Chinese film we have on either of our lists. And a lot of that comes down to the fact that Chinese cinema was my introduction to international film. Back in, when was this? It would have been Monsters, Inc. had just come out. So my dad had taken me and a friend to Monsters, Inc. We finished Monsters, Inc. And my dad was like, hey, Iron Monkey's playing at the other theater in town. Let's go watch it. That was my introduction to international cinema. For some reason, this 1993 Kung Fu movie was playing in town. And I went and saw it late night after seeing Monsters, Inc. And I was sold. I absolutely loved it. And fast forward a few years, and I first saw Hero in 2009. And this movie blows me away. It's one of the most gorgeous films ever made. There's no doubt about it. The use of color in this film is absolutely astonishing. The cast, phenomenal. We're talking Jet Li, Tony Leung, Maggie Cheung, and Donnie Yen, all in the same film. Absolutely incredible. 2002, it was very popular at the time because we were getting a lot of Chinese cinema in North America at that time. Coming off the heels of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, which was a huge success, we had a lot of penetration of this movies where we had Chinese cinema films releasing probably every 6 months in North America for the next like 3 or 4 years, and then it died off. But what Hero does very differently is it's pulling more on these the style of Japanese cinema in the storytelling. Because when we get down to it, Hero is very similar to Akira Kurosawa's Rashomon in its storytelling, where we get different perspectives of the story throughout. But what's done so well in this movie is how stylistically the colors, the choice to make each of these different perspectives a different color, makes it so much easier to identify who's telling the story when. But it also, it's so visually stunning.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the Rashomon comparisons were really, really easy for me to pick up on there. And that was the one thing that I did appreciate about this movie. I ultimately gave it 2.5 stars. And when I say that this is not my style, like I have to rewatch Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon because I haven't watched it since I was like 9 years old. But it is just not a genre that does anything for me. The whole like floating and screaming and all that, like it just doesn't. It doesn't matter to me. I find it to be very, very corny, and it just doesn't work. But I will agree with you. The reason why I went with 2.5 on this instead of 2, which is what my heart was really telling me, is because the way that this film is put together is pretty spectacular. And that's a hard thing to ignore, even if you find the entire thing to be generally pretty boring, which I did. And it's not boring from a sense that how it was filmed or the action sequence or anything like that. It's just, it was a story that I really didn't care anything about. But when you start to look at this movie and some of the grand shots that are in this movie, it's unbelievably impressive. And especially since we're so limited on the Chinese cinema that we see because of, you know, the government in China, it makes it all the more interesting when you do get to see a Chinese film that is shot on location in China. And it makes for a big difference. And especially you'll see a lot of Chinese co-productions such as The Meg, but Jason Statham's always going to be the main character in that movie. There's always going to be a massive American celebrity so that America and China are both going to make the same amount of money on these movies. They're both going to have big hits because it's two people that are going to be big in the East and big in the West. But for a movie like Hero, where that wasn't happening, Jet Li wasn't a household name by any means. This was a big deal and incredibly well put together. Was it Zhang Yimou is the director of this one? If I pronounce that correctly. And he also did House of Flying Daggers and I forget the other one, but he's done a lot of these types of movies that have been very, very successful in America, which I think speaks to the fact that he's not just making a martial arts movie. He is adding a very artistic element to this. It's just, this is just a genre that no matter how many times I sit down and watch it, I'm literally just going to be like, okay, like I get it. And it's just not, it just doesn't hit home.
Yeah. And I get that because like this, like subgenre of like wire food, where it's a lot of like suspending on wires and a lot of like twirling and fighting in the air and everything like that, isn't for everyone. For me, someone who spent a lot of time doing theatrical works, choreography for fight scenes has always fascinated me. I love fight scene choreography, and I think that like the wire foo fight scene is just such this unique animal that we don't see anymore. It's 20 years, we're 20 years removed from when this was incredibly popular. And it's so fascinating to see what they're doing and knowing that like these flips and turns are all being orchestrated by people pulling on wires to make them do them. I think there's just like this beauty in that, that when these fights happen, they're not really fights. They're more dances and just the characters interacting in the way that two dancers would interact.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. I think that's a very good good assessment of it. And that's the thing that like I can still take from this. Like I still absolutely like admire what is being done in these scenes. It's just, it's so different. And it's funny though that Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon came out the year after The Matrix. Would it have been nearly as successful if it hadn't come out right after The Matrix, which really did bring this, not wire foo necessarily, but this style into such a mainstream. The Matrix is one of the biggest movies ever. And so for that to come out right before Crouching Tiger and Dragon, and this to build off of that 2 years later, it really did have the best timing for this type of movie to happen. Again, it's more of like when it's like, I'm now going to float at you and scream, and then you're going to respond by floating at me and screaming. I don't like, I'm questioning why. Why is that the approach? Because not for nothing, watching somebody do kung fu in a movie is very entertaining within itself. Watching these super choreographed, nowadays when you have a fight scene, a sword fight scene in Game of Thrones or whatever, give me, you know, the really crappy fight scene in Star Wars, the original one, and I'm happy because that's what it should look like. Mm-hmm. I like that it's a little bit less choreographed. But in a movie like this where it is meant to be choreographed, and you're knowing that you're watching these super skilled fighters during this era that, like, you know, there's so much of a mystique about, I sit down and I wonder, why do they have to add that extra element? What is it that makes that more appealing? And since this isn't your top 100, I am turning that question to you. And maybe you know why this is something that they wanted to do or why people were into it.
So I think a lot of it comes down to Chinese culture and the inclusion of just like that spiritual and supernatural elements to Chinese culture. And I think having these supernatural abilities of these people to do, like to fly and to like do all these flips and stuff, gives it kind of this mythical element that kind of elevates it and really reinforces the idea of the storytelling aspect, which is so important in this film specifically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that works. And I will say, the score to this movie that is fitting behind all of this is beautiful. And it really does. It's very relaxing. And that was something that I thought was very interesting, because for a movie that is pretty fast paced, has a lot of action scenes, has a lot of betrayals and things like that, to have such a relaxing score kind of acting like counterproductive almost to the fight scenes that are happening, it does make more sense with what you're saying, where it is like this mythology. It is what, you know, whatever word you just used that I'm completely drawing a blank on.
Mystical.
Mystical. Thank you. I don't know why I couldn't think of mystical, but it does add more to that. It really does, by just saying, hey, you know, here's this score, here's people floating, whatever. It's almost like, I'm trying to think, like, I guess it's funny that we're talking about this movie coming off of Whit Stillman's second movie that we talked about here. Because they're both such acquired tastes. Like, you really have to be into this kind of thing. What I find most interesting about movies like Hero, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, you know, House of Flying Daggers. I'm trying to think what other ones there are here. Even Kill Bill has a little bit of it, but not really. I find it interesting that it's not always the biggest movie fans who love these types of movies. It is something that has found a way to be universal, but still to a very select group. It's just, it's a very strange, you'll get your huge cinephiles who love these kinds of movies, but then you also get your cinephiles who hate these movies, but it still transcends somehow into these, you know, people who aren't necessarily watching a movie a day like we just did, but they still are like, yo, Hero's the coolest thing ever. I've never seen anything like it. And maybe that is what the appeal is.
Yeah, I think it's just, I think one of the big things with like a movie like Hero is it's not trying to go too high concept with you. Like, we talked about the beauty of the colors in all the different stories. There's no deeper meaning to which color is being used when. Like, it started with the premise of, I like this red stuff, so we're going to do like this red scene here. Then it moved into, okay, we're going to do the whites because it matches the desert. And the blue, because it matches the lake. I guess that leaves us with like the black for this imperial city.
Yeah.
And green's the last color left. So that's the one we're going to use.
Yeah. And it works though. Like it does feel purposeful. I think you froze, but it does feel purposeful. the entire time. And I think the Imperial City itself is actually quite an interesting looking thing. Can you hear me or no? I think I've lost John, so I'm just going to keep talking. The Imperial City itself is a very impressive set. And what's even more impressive about it is all of the real people that they use as extras in this movie, rather than just making it, you know, a bunch of CGI or anything like that, because this was an era where CGI was very simple. I mean, 2001 was Lord of the Rings, the first one, so this was definitely something they could have done. But they went full on with, like, you know, all people, going the Lawrence of Arabia route with this. And it's a very interesting thing. I always say that, yeah, it costs a lot of money to do this, but when you do that, it makes your movie so much more timeless, no matter what colors you use, or, you know, if you're you're doing it on purpose or not on purpose or whatever it is. You make your movie timeless by using real life people in this, because you go back and watch Lawrence of Arabia, it looks like anybody could have shot it today. If you go back and watch the first Lord of the Rings, it still very much holds up. But there's going to be a day and a time where we say, why are they standing in squares? Which I've been saying since pretty much 2007. Why are they standing in such perfect squares, and why are they not filling it in? Well, because that's how they drew it in the computer design. So like, that's it's very impressive. And I will say that, like, normally when a movie that's made and it's very popular in China does make its way to America, we normally see this massive, massive budget behind it in this situation where they are using extras and they are using real locations and they're not cutting corners at all. With the production.
Yeah, and I think it's that aspect of the realism of actually using people which really makes it easy to connect to this type of movie too. Because, like you said, when we see these, like, irregular shapes and, like, these perfect squares and stuff with people and bodies and everything, it kind of takes you out of it. Whereas when you have the King's Guard just all, like, filing into the room, like, that's it. It elicits an emotional response because it is real, because it is hundreds of people rushing up these stairs into this throne room.
Yeah, it's all real. And that's something we see now a lot. Like, you know, you go back and you watch movies that have the budget to do this kind of thing. Don't. And you go back and watch the second trilogy of Star Wars. Everything in that movie is CGI and green screen. They didn't need to make that all CGI and green screen. They could have absolutely done something like this. They knew they were going to make $1 billion on that first movie. Go ahead and put the budget behind it, but they didn't do it. And I think that's why that movie suffers so much, besides the fact that the story is total bullshit and mitochlorians and whatever. But that's for another day, maybe.
Yeah.
But I do think that, like, when it is useful, the reason why a movie like Hero, it draws the comparisons to Rashomon. It is one of those movies that still gets discussed, even though Wire Fu has gone out of style. The reason is that it is something that could be done now. It doesn't look dated really in any way. Wire Fu itself was always going to be dated. There was no way it was ever going to get through time without being dated. It was always going to look kind of silly from time to time. But the decision to do everything really in camera, It's why this movie and Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon are generally the two that are mentioned when discussing this martial arts genre and not talking about Bruce Lee.
And especially when we're talking about Hero, a lot of it also comes from the fact that each fight scene is so different than the one that precedes it. Like, despite the fact that we get literal retelling of, like, the same scenario three times, the fights are all so completely different. The first fight between Jet Li and Donnie Yen is just this beautiful choreographed dance to this music that's going on. And the battle isn't even happening in front of people because it's a mental battle.
Yeah. I love the mental battle. I thought that was the best part of the movie, to be honest with you.
Oh, yeah. It's one of the most talked about scenes in this entire film. And it's absolutely gorgeous. The subtlety of the blues, the fact that the rain is being used in the music, and the fact that as soon as, like, the strings snap and then they actually lunge at each other, it's gorgeous, and it sets up everything, because later in the movie we find out, oh, this was staged in order to get Nameless closer to the king.
Yeah, and I think those reveals throughout really work too. You know, like, the storytelling in this movie is very good. It's one of those movies you definitely need to watch more than once, probably to pick up on all of the little things that are going on, because until you realize that this was staged, you're kind of just like, okay, like, they did that, and then it happened, and it's over. But once you start to realize that it's staged, you start to realize the actual importance of all of this. And then probably going back and rewatching that opening is going to make it almost seem like you're watching a different movie. But again, like movie, like the reason why it's being discussed is because it does have that rewatchability. You do learn something new every time you watch it. Very rarely are we going to sit down and talk about a movie on this podcast where you're not going to get something different from it the second or third viewing, like where it's just going to be the same experience every single time. That's not going to happen unless, of course, John would let me do an entire hour about Armageddon, because I would be more than happy to do that. But
you're
not going to get anything different about Armageddon each time, even if it is, you know, the greatest guilty pleasure ever made.
Yeah. And then because even if we're looking at Hero, like you're not going to pick up on these subtleties in the Red story, in the calligraphy story, where Nameless is kind of tooting his own horn quite a bit in that story with like, oh yeah, I totally knew that they were secret lovers and they were going to like get mad at each other for sleeping with the other one. And even when he goes out and, flying snow is deflecting all the arrows and then he goes out there and he deflects them all and she's complimenting him, and then he comes back in to see Broken Sword's scroll that he's made, and Broken Sword's like, oh well, this scroll wouldn't exist if weren't there defending the arrows. It's those little tiny bits of ego that come through in that story that really kind of show how the King of Jin can realize that what he's saying isn't true.
Well, yeah, that and it also it gives you that unreliable narrator, and it's telling you right off the bat that this narrator is unreliable. And I think that, you know, we see that a lot in movies, and a lot of times that does work out in the favor of the writer. But especially in a movie like this, where like there is so much with honor and you know, like defeating each other for the betterment of this country and all of that, to then be lying to the king and exaggerating and making it seem like you're better than you are, even if you are that good. I do agree. It kind of adds like a little bit more of an element beneath the surface of what kind of guy this guy is, which makes his decision at the end all the less crazy, because you see that he is so egotistical that he thinks by him dying, it's actually going to be for the betterment of all of China.
Yeah, and that's kind of the beauty of where this the theme of this movie shifts to. Because at first, it seems like, oh, there's this tyrannical king of this one province who's trying to, like, dominate these other provinces. And then we get the storyline with Broken Sword, where he writes Our Land in the Sand. And he explains the fact that when he had the opportunity to assassinate the king, he decided not to, because he realized that the king was kind of the only way to make all this fighting end. And that shift in perspective there towards the end, where you get the idea of, wait, who's actually the villain in this movie? Is it this king who we've been told is tyrannical, who even says that his court knows he's tyrannical, but is overall working for this greater good of uniting these provinces? And of course, this is historical too, right? Like, this is a historical thing that happened in China, which I think also lends to how impactful this movie can be. And having Nameless just get to that point where he realizes, I'm a dead man no matter what happens here. But now I can understand that what the King of Qin's doing is trying to unite all these other provinces so that there can be a united China. So there could be a China in the first place.
Yeah. Yeah. And even if that means war to get there, it's still going to get there with a better chance than anything else. And it works. And, you know, I mean, China, I do like though, like at the beginning of like Chinese productions will be like the great country of China. Like they, like Chinese productions will always use the adjective ahead of, ahead of China every time. So I just think that that's like funny, but it works out. And ultimately, you know, I like the whole part about like the Great Wall and stuff at the end, because you want to talk about a country that Americans really get no background on, it's China. You know, I mean, we've heard about China a lot, obviously, over the last 2 years. Other than that, we're not really thinking about China here. It says made in China on pretty much everything we own, but that's really the only thing that we, that's like the only thing we know about China. We don't really know anything else. Yeah, we don't get we don't get history on China. So that's, I thought the whole Great Wall of China thing was cool.
That's fascinating to me because I've always been fascinated with China and their history and everything since like elementary school when I first learned about like the history of China and the ancient civilization of China and its progression into the modern era. And even when I taught grade 8 social studies, I was teaching about China because of how prevalent it is in today's society and the importance it has to the world we live in. So that's fascinating to know that that's more absent from the American education system.
Yeah.
And perhaps another reason why I can relate to this film more than you can.
Probably. I mean, although I do find a lot of the stuff with China very interesting. Like, I think that's why Survivor China is my favorite season of the show.
Yeah.
And I mean, but I think the extent of like my Chinese background knowledge was going to Walt Disney World and they had the Chinese pavilion. I think that's really the extent of it. You know, a place. I don't know. It was just, I guess, because also like it was so close to trade and everything like that, like during the time. And yeah, never really heard much. So I do. But I do think ultimately, this movie being the genre that this movie is, it was just, it was never going to work for me no matter what. It really didn't matter. It was just never going to work. So it was funny. I didn't realize that this was the type of movie it was. I didn't realize it was a wire fu movie. I just thought it was a martial arts movie where like people were going to beat each other up. And the first time the person floated, I was like, oh shit. Like, here we go. Okay. But this is actually only the second version of those movies that I've seen, unless Kung Fu Hustle counts. Which is obviously the spoof on these types of movies, which is quite funny and came out not too long after all of these. But this was really only the second one. Obviously, I've seen the different, you know, Charlie's Angels and things like that. Yeah. But those are mocking, I feel. Mm.
Yeah, I just think that this is a movie. It's a kind of a subgenre of cinema that a lot of people don't investigate quite a lot. And especially now, because I feel like anyone who is kind of born probably even like 5 years after you and I were born, didn't live through this era where Hong Kong and Chinese cinema was penetrating into North America. And it was so prevalent at that turn of the millennia. So it's like you said, it's kind of faded off because of that, but there are some gems and the cinematography and use of color and storytelling in Hero is just why it lands on my top 100.
Yeah. No, and I will say that that's why I almost felt bad when I was like, can I really give a movie like this 2 stars? Like, just because it's not for me? Not really. Not really. And so I bumped it up half. The cinematography is something. It's something. And the performances are good, too, even though they always kind of take second. They play second fiddle to the martial arts in the movie.
I think Tony Leung's performance in this is top notch. I think it's an incredible performance. And I always love seeing Tony Leung in films.
Well, it also is probably part of the reason why Tony Leung is pretty much the most, even though he's not the most famous out of them, he's probably the one who's in the most real movies.
Both him and Maggie Cheung are both in The Mood for Love, right?
So. Yeah, In the Mood for Love, Lost Caution. I mean, he's definitely more of an actor than Jet Li was. Jet Li was definitely more of a
martial artist. Yes.
So, yeah, I hear you. Anything else you want to say about this or should we bump?
No, let's keep going.
Okay. So I didn't watch anything else in the 3 days spanning between when we did our last episode and when we did this one. So I'll just say that I did write an article for Collider about the best January releases since 2000. So go check that out. That would be a good indication. Spoilers, Paddington 2 is number one. But I did the 8 best January releases since 2000. So that's what I got. Didn't watch a movie. So John, what do you got?
I did watch one movie right after we finished our podcast. I rushed out. I watched the latest release from the Scream franchise. Aptly call it titled Scream. It was really good. I really enjoyed it. It definitely sits in the top half of the franchise for quality, in my opinion. I obviously don't want to spoil anything. The reason why I went and saw it on opening night was because I didn't want to get spoiled who the killer was. I wanted to avoid that as much as possible. But it kind of, where Scream 4 kind of tried to do this like reboot thing, but gave us like this separate, like focusing on the original like legacy characters and the new cast, and it kind of like split attention. It couldn't really decide what movie it was trying to be. This newest Scream did a very much better job of like reinvigorating the franchise, in my opinion, where they paid homage to the previous films in the franchise acknowledge the legacy characters, but kind of still let them take the back seat to the new characters. Mm-hmm. And it very well could lead. Does it need to lead to more Scream movies? No, but it leaves the door open for them if they're handled as well. And the team that created this movie, because obviously this is the first one that Wes Craven hasn't directed, mm-hmm. they clearly love this franchise and they definitely did it justice.
That's good to hear. Yeah, I'll have to check it out at some point. I kind of forgot it was even coming out. It's just crazy. It's so weird because when you live in South Florida and the weather's the same all the time for the most mm-hmm. part, you kind of forget that like it's January and that means like you're either going to get one kind of good horror movie or a bunch of crappy movies. It's a weird seasonal thing because even living in LA, the weather got cold. You know, here it does not. So yeah, I'll have to check out Scream at some point and see what I think of that. But I got to watch a bunch of Oscar movies first because I've watched nothing. anyway, all right, let's go on to Drive, which I used to replace The Social Network. The reason I kind of did this was just because I thought with Driver and Mark Zuckerberg, they're both definitely anti-heroes. They're both bad people that you root for throughout the movie. And I think both of them are trying to do the right thing. I think definitely more of Driver is trying to do the right thing than Mark Zuckerberg. But I do think that they're both trying to do the right thing the way they know how and find their success and find whatever they need to find in their own way. That's why I chose it. They're both dark movies. They're both very stylized movies. And I think like Drive is hyper stylized to the point where it's hard not to notice. But The Social Network is also a very hyper stylized movie. He runs around in flip-flops in Harvard. So I think that's there's something to be said for that. Two, I love Drive. Drive is one of those movies that was on my top 100. It fell off, comes back, falls off. It's one of those movies you have to definitely be in the mood for, and that's why it ultimately doesn't land on my top 100 list. But I still think it's a great movie. I think Nicholas Winding Refn did a fantastic job of building this up and building and working his way to the extreme violence that the last 40 minutes of this movie exude. So much violence. Everybody gets blown up. Everybody gets shot. Heads. I mean, the wrist slitting scene is ridiculous. Mm-hmm. There is so much blood in the second half of this movie, but the first half is very methodical. It's very much like, hey, I'm going to bring you into this story. I'm going to kind of like get him to the point where it almost seems like he's going to talk. And then that's it. I think that the opening of this movie is absolutely phenomenal. Almost no dialogue. That is filmmaking. It is just pure direction. It is just the sounds of the car and the background voices talking about who they're chasing down. Does a great job of building the intensity of everything. I love the 80s score to this. I think it's very funny set against this. It's just such a pulpy movie. And Ron Perlman, Albert Brooks, Carey Mulligan, Oscar Isaac, Ryan Gosling, they're all great. Bryan Cranston, phenomenal. Ron Perlman is the one who cracks me up the most. I think him laughing in the Nino scene is one of the fun. When he's talking to that lady and he's laughing and she's just standing there, you can just tell she hates everything. I think that scene is so funny. But Albert Brooks playing completely against type in this movie does a fantastic job. I think got snubbed of an Oscar. But I know that this didn't do it for you on this viewing. I'm curious to hear why, but this is a movie that I look forward to sitting down and watching this movie when I sit down and watch it.
So, yeah, when I first watched it, I watched this for the first time last year at this point. And I enjoyed it. Like, it's fine. It's a good movie. Like you said, the cast is phenomenal. The performances are very good. My qualms with this film come from the plot is very thin.
Yeah.
And it's very, like, circumstantial at best. But the thing that drives me absolutely insane about this film is the characters are never developed.
See, I that's to me part of the stylized part of this is right. that the characters and the story ultimately are taking a back seat to everything else that's happening. Like, this is meant to be your standard,
like
fair of got to get back at the mob and how did you get turned into this and what's going on. And it's just so overblown with somebody like Ryan Gosling's character of Driver, who literally doesn't talk. The reactions that he's getting from a lot of characters don't seem realistic throughout the movie. But again, adding to that stylized nature of the movie, Oscar Isaac should have kicked the shit out of Ryan Gosling in this movie. Like, there's no way he's not thinking that he's sleeping with Carey Mulligan. But that doesn't happen. So I think that he's just leaning into it really, really hard. And I think all you need to know about these characters is you know the most about Driver. And I think keeping him mysterious and not getting into his background is a smart decision. I think that everybody else is meant to be a caricature of what you see in these normal crime movies, but they're taken to the next level. Like, you can see Ron Perlman winking at the camera when he's saying half the shit that he's saying.
I can't stand Ron Perlman's performance in this
movie. I think it's so funny.
I can't stand it.
So over the top. But again, I think that that's the type of character you always see in these crime movies where it's taking it 100% seriously. And I think that by casting Ron Perlman and playing it this way, he's not taking it as seriously as the movie is acting like he's taking it. Like, this movie is not taking itself all that seriously. It's meaning to kind of draw that comparisons to those 80s, 90s crime thrillers that were just so ridiculous and their characters did nothing, but it's doing it in such an artistic way that you end up with, I mean, the scene in the elevator to me is just one of the best scenes from the 2010s. I love that scene so much. The slow motion, the score, how the lighting fades. It's brilliant. And we're going to be talking about A Single Man in, I think, 2 weeks with lighting techniques and such. Yeah. Tom Ford's lighting in that movie is ridiculous. And then it turns to him just beating the crap out of the person, stomping on his head until it turns to mush, and Carey Mulligan just staring at him covered in blood, like without speaking again. And I think that those decisions really ultimately make this great. But one thing I will say is Nicholas Winding Refn is 100% this is the only movie that he made that was good. All his other movies are boring. I think they're so boring because he gets too into himself. But this one, for some reason, just clicks for me. It just absolutely clicks.
Yeah, I get it. And like you've highlighted the two scenes that I think are absolutely the most memorable from this, and that is the opening sequence and the elevator scene. I think those are absolutely phenomenal scenes. And I kind of just wish the rest of the film felt that way for me. I think really what it comes is you get in this big high because that opening sequence is absolutely beautiful. It's fantastic. It's tense. And then you kind of see like the ingenuity of Driver at that point and how he's approaching the situation, why he's so strict about like when the timing has to happen, how calculated he is. And I love that. And then we get further into the movie. He gets a lot more emotional and like that's understandable, but it doesn't seem to fit that same character mold that he had before where he was so calculated.
Well, he's letting his guard down and what starts to happen. Everything starts to go wrong because he starts to actually build up relationships and things are now going wrong for him and he needs to get back to his calculated ways.
But the elevator scene is an absolutely gorgeous scene. Just like taking that moment, the slow motion, the realization that this guy has a gun is definitely there for him. The kiss with Carey Mulligan to the extreme hyper-violence that happens afterwards is gorgeous. It's that contrast that really makes that scene work. And not just the contrast in like theme, but also the contrast in slow motion to this incredibly frantic fight. It is great. And it is when this film is hitting, it's hitting really well. It's just, I just need a little bit more. A little bit more would have given it to me. A little, like, even like you said, Oscar Isaac's character would be, like, beating the shit out of him because he clearly thinks he's sleeping with his wife. Even just, like, that little bit of conversation more, I think would help elevate this film for me.
Yeah, it's funny because when this was in my top 100, the viewing that knocked it off my top 100 was what you just discussed. Is after the opening scene, there's about 20 minutes of this movie where it slows down a lot. A lot. And it really does almost, you're like, what is going on? I appreciate it a lot more this time, almost because my expectations were so low for that scene. Because this was the first time I watched it since I decided, you know, that's not in that list anymore. So that my expectations were so low there that all of a sudden I'm like, wait, no, this is really cool. Like, I like how stylized this is. I like how over the top. But it slows down a lot and it takes its time before it finally gets. But as soon as Oscar Isaac is out of prison from that point on, I think that this movie is just like flying. But it is a little weird, especially since it's not something that we've ever really seen in movies, which is they're building their relationship with no dialogue. They're literally just standing there. And people say, well, there's physical relationships all the time in movies. Yes, but this one really has no dialogue. Like, there's no conversation happening in this movie. And if you're a fan of conversations, this is not the movie for you, because a lot of it is just nodding and grunting and whatever. But I also think that it's cool that, you know, Ryan Gosling plays a stuntman, a stunt driver who has to wear the mask the whole time. And he's pretending to be somebody that he's not, and all of those fun things. And, like, you know, diving into that and how, you know, he could take the bullet to protect whoever else who's more important than him, which ultimately is Carey Mulligan's character, and all of that fun stuff. But there's, like, no conversation. Bryan Cranston probably speaks the most in the first half hour of this movie. And he's probably in 2 minutes of it. And then once Albert Brooks actually comes up with his plan, I mean, Albert Brooks is maybe in 7 to 8 minutes of this movie. He does a lot with those 7 to 8 minutes of this movie.
He does. And I mean, like we were talking with Hero and how, like, phenomenal that cast is. This cast is phenomenal through 2011. I am personally, like, a big proponent that Ryan Gosling's really underrated as an actor. I think he's a phenomenal actor.
He's top 10. Like, he's ridiculous. Yeah,
he's absolutely incredible. And, like, he kind of got shoehorned early on in his career into, like, all those like chick flick movies. And this was kind of his big coming out of that, where when this released in 2011, this was the movie everyone was talking
about. Oh, yeah.
This, and, like, somehow I managed to go 10 years without seeing it. But
oh, so you watched it for the first time in 2021?
I did.
Wow.
Yeah. But, like, when this – and I remember, I was in university at this time. All my friends were like, oh, my God, have you seen Drive? And, like, just never got around to it. But, like, this was the movie when it was released. And there's a reason why it's kind of lingers there as this movie everyone in our generation talks about. Because it kind of came out at the perfect time for all those people where it was – it is that pulpy escapism that we didn't really see – at the time, outside of Tarantino films.
Yeah, so I have to bring this up because I think you'll find this funny, because you said he kind of got shoehorned into chick flicks, which most people would think, you know, it would be like he falls into that Brad Pitt, Matthew McConaughey type thing. We're like, yeah, he was a great actor, but he was really falling into this. If you go and look at his history of movies, he is in literally one chick flick.
Oh, yeah, I know.
It just happens to be The Notebook, which is what screwed him. Yep. It happens to be The Notebook, because actually before this movie came out, he'd been nominated for the Oscar for Half Nelson. So that was a big thing. And that came out 2 years after The Notebook. Fracture, where he plays opposite Anthony Hopkins, is a very good movie. And one that actually, you know, started to get, it was like, okay, maybe this guy really can act. I don't know. And then he does Lars and the Real Girl, which is a very weird, not chick flick at all. But then he follows that one up with Blue Valentine. So he was really not a chick flick actor.
But he was shoehorned into that because of the chick flick he was in.
He was shoehorned into, he's just the good looking guy and he's not that good actor. I say this all the time. Him in Blue Valentine is probably my favorite performance in the history of film. Like, and I mean that wholeheartedly. And I've seen way too many movies. I haven't seen everything, but I've seen a lot. And I would say that his performance is probably my favorite performance in the history of film. It is ridiculous what he does in that movie. And he doesn't even get nominated for the Oscar. And the funniest part is, if you were watching the Oscars that night when Michelle Williams got nominated, they showed a scene for why she was nominated. Yeah. And the whole scene is Ryan Gosling. It's just him owning it. So I completely agree with you. I think Ryan Gosling is one of the most underrated actors in the history of cinema, because he never really made the leap that McConaughey or Pitt made, where now he's universally acclaimed. Ryan Gosling has been nominated for numerous Oscars. I think it's 3, right? He's been nominated for 2. So it's only 2, because he was La La Land and he somehow didn't get nominated for Blue Valentine, which is the biggest snub in the history of anything. It's ridiculous. But 2 Oscar nominations over a very long career. He started off in 1993. I mean, he was a child. He was 13 years old. Now he's 41. If you look at the movies he's in, when he comes out in a movie, it's not a movie where it's like, oh, good, I'm so excited that Cameron Diaz is in another movie. It's, oh, this is going to be a good movie because Ryan Gosling's in it. We saw that with First Man, La La Land. You know, I mean, obviously, Giselle was a big part of both of those. The Place Beyond the Pines, people really thought that one was going to be better than it was. The Nice Guys with him and Russell Crowe. Blade Runner 2049. He's in so many movies.
Yeah.
But it is funny that if you had to say what is the most iconic one, most people would say The Notebook, but this is his iconic
role. This is the other one. Yeah.
This is his iconic role. Because everybody, it's more the line in The Notebook. It's more the line in The Notebook when he's, you know, in the rain and the water and all that. Everybody knows that. But in terms of what was the defining role of Ryan Gosling's career that made everybody want to be Ryan Gosling, it's this movie. And what happened was most people discovered Blue Valentine after this movie. Yeah. And that's why they decided, wow, I really want to be this guy. And when he's doing the little finger snap in Blue Valentine, I mean, that's how every guy thinks they can woo women now. So well done.
Yeah. And it's great. And I mean, I guess we're kind of at a point where Brad, like you made the comparison to Brad Pitt and Matthew McConaughey, and they did have to wait a long time before making that jump. And I guess he is kind of like that, just a bit back. And hopefully, like after La La Land, it's going to be interesting to see where Ryan Gosling's career goes from here, because I do think he will start taking those incredibly serious roles pretty quick here.
Well, he's also in his 40s now. He's not as much of the heartthrob as he was, even though he's still incredibly good looking. But he also hasn't been in a movie in 4 years. Mainly because, you know, him and Eva Mendes had their kid. So it seems like he's really taken off because of that without announcing he was retiring like Daniel Day-Lewis does every other year. Like, I do agree with you. I think that like he's got three movies. I'm on his IMDb right now. He's got one movie in post-production, two in pre-production, and two that are announced. You'd have to assume that these are going to be pretty meaty roles that it's like, hey, I want to win my Oscar. Because you have to think about, Leo kind of had a similar route too. Leo started off obviously as a great actor. Everybody knew it. But Titanic, Leo is far from great in that movie. That's probably his most iconic role. Until Wolf of Wall Street came around, and then that changed everything. But
looping back onto Driver now. Obviously, Ryan Gosling isn't the only performance that's great. Carey Mulligan's great in this film. Like, he's in everything she's in. But Oscar Isaac, for being in this film for, like, 5 minutes, to me, really steals the show. Like, his character is... because you have an expectation for who his character is going to be. And, like, that is what this film does really well, is set up Oscar Isaac. You know he's a criminal. You're like, okay, what's going on? Then he has that really awkward conversation about how him and Carey Mulligan's character met. To his child, which is not a conversation you should have with your child. I illegally seduced your mother. Okay, cool. But he's just, because it's set up, because there's, it really plays on stigma. Because we're looking at a crime movie, we know that Ryan Gosling's a getaway driver. We know that there's like this crime underbelly introduced because we've seen Nino already. And then we have Standard come in. And he's been in jail, so you expect him to be like this hardened thug. But you kind of get him, he knows he's made mistakes, and he's really this really redeemable character. And when he gets shot, you're actually a bit devastated because you think, you think this movie is going to be completely different than that, because you think it's kind of going to be like shift to this, the weird sexual tension between Standard and Driver. But what it then turns into is this hyper-violent pulp film after that.
Yeah, and I think though, that's what I like so much about this movie too, is how it subverts your expectations in so many ways. And a lot of that has to do with Oscar Isaac was just on the cusp of having his breakout when this movie came. You know, he hadn't been able to get there yet. But then after this movie was when he really just started rattling off like hit after hit. He had Inside Llewyn Davis and A Most Violent Year, Ex Machina. You know, then he gets into the Star Wars movies. I mean, it just was pretty relentless after this. It just took him a little bit to get going. I think it helps having an actor as good as him. But I love the decisions to not just have him be the over aggressive. We've seen that a million times. So yeah, let's have it be a different version of that. Let's have it be that Carey Mulligan and Oscar Isaac don't have any type of feuding between them. Let's just have it so that it works. And I think that is where this movie excels. When he dies, you're shocked because also he just came into the movie and now he's gone. Yeah. Now Driver is driving around with Christina Hendricks rather than Oscar Isaac. And Christina Hendricks was just introduced. So what are we doing? Also, Christina Hendricks getting her head blown off is one of the most ridiculously violent moments in film history. But yeah, that scene, like that decision to make it move that quickly, that's not a decision that a lot of people would make in their movies. And I it almost reminds me of Children of Men when they make the decision, spoilers, one, two, three, four, five, when they make the decision to kill Julianne Moore. it feels very much reminiscent of that, because you feel like that's going to be your secondary through line. That's going to be your adversary for Clive Owen the whole time. You know, what's their tension like, and how is he going to get dragged into this world? And then she's gone. You know, that's kind of what this feels like to me, where it's like Oscar Isaac's going to bring him into this world deeper and deeper until it's unrelenting, and they're going to have to butt heads a little bit to get there. And instead, Oscar Isaac dies and Driver just gets to stay alone, which is a brilliant decision, because Driver has to be a loner, has no choice but to be absolutely alone in these movies.
Yeah. And it almost feels like it's kind of replicating how you drive like a standard. And I think that's really important, because, mm-hmm. man, there's no scene that frustrates me. There are two scenes in this movie that really frustrate me. The one is when Carey Mulligan grabs his shifting hand. And I'm like, Carey, come on. He needs that to drive.
He needs
like,
that don't to drive, do that. Yeah. That's a good point.
The other one is when he's cleaning the straight razor and just, like, directly puts dish soap on it. Mm-hmm. Like, that can't be good for your straight razor.
Bernie Ross doesn't care, man.
Yeah, clearly. But other than that, it does kind of feel like it's like playing on this idea of driving a stick shift, where mm-hmm. you get that first stuff and you're in a higher gear, and then you shift down and we get really slow. We're kind of in neutral for a while, and then we just pick up, and then we just keep revving up and going faster and faster as we head towards the end of the film.
Yeah, and another scene that I really love is when he rams his car into Ron Perlman, and it just makes me think of like, that really is like your climax, because yeah. then you're cruising again by the time you get to the part with Bernie Ross. But that scene is great, and going into the water, and they don't even have to show him die, but he keeps the mask on, and it's just that blank stare, I think is phenomenal. And I also love the way the movie ends. I think that shot where Ryan Gosling is sitting in the car, not moving, not blinking, you're like, he's dead. And it holds for probably about 25 seconds. And then finally he closes his eyes. And I do agree, though, like this whole like stick shift thing, it's like that's the end. Like now your drive is over. What are you going to like? So now it's that complete. And then he just starts going again. So I'm curious to see what his life would have been like after all of this.
Yeah, but it's so nice that we don't have to worry about that.
I know. Do you think he dies or lives?
Oh, he was stabbed. He was stabbed in the stomach. That's going to take a while to kill him, right? He could probably get to a hospital.
I'm just saying, though, like, do you think, because like in that moment, if you start to hear what's happening, and you know, obviously creating these theories is nonsense, but is he dead? Does he get killed by Bernie Ross and then kill Bernie Ross? And then that's it. He dies, because he's sitting there and he's staring blankly. The music slowly starts to come in, and it's almost like, okay, now he's finally died and he's the real hero, the real human being. And he goes driving off into the sunset. He gets his sunset moment, but is he already dead?
That's a good point.
It feels almost like with how long he holds there, mm-hmm. it almost feels like if you get stabbed in the stomach, you hit, there's so many vital organs down there that you could die pretty much immediately.
Yeah. So I suppose it also kind of explains like that shot where it like goes away from it to focus on Carey Mulligan knocking on his door too, and him not being there.
Exactly. Cause we know that he would leave. He's not going to necessarily go back, but maybe he's just dead. You know what I mean? Like, it just feels like, and who's going to care if this guy dies? Nobody's going to ever follow up on that or anything.
So. I mean, he's nameless, right?
Yeah.
We watched two movies with nameless characters in them this time.
We did. That's actually really weird. I didn't even think about that.
But I think like that's also leads into how this movie, like the hyper-stylization of this movie is, it's that man with no name aspect to it, mm-hmm. right? Which I think is like so important. Because, and I think we've kind of gotten away from that a lot in recent years, where we don't really focus on like the character itself rather than like the named character. Mm-hmm. And that is what Drive does really well, is because, like I said, the character, I didn't think the character was very well developed, especially with like the rapid shift in behavior. But what it does do is, because there's no name to hang up on, we can mm-hmm. focus on that.
Yeah, it's funny. This was something that was really done in like the 90s and the early 2000s and everything. And it almost became like cliche at mm-hmm. some point, and people stopped doing it. And I think a lot of that too also has to do with the fact that like a lot more films have started to become more female heavy, or you know, like they've kind of shifted away from like this badass guy motif. Although I do think that there's something to be said about the movies that do it right. There's some movies that just do it for the sake of doing it, but a movie like Drive, a movie like Fight Club, these movies that do it with a purpose really, really work. And what I think makes it cool too, is it adds the mystery of the character, but also makes it so that the character is literally anyone. The character is what you think this person's backstory is. It's not what they're telling you their backstory is. It's what you think the backstory is. And I think that's really interesting. It is funny though, how this is such a popular genre. And probably the reason why people our age are so into movies, because these were the movies we were watching in our early teens, yeah. and that was bringing us into film, how it has really fallen out. I'm trying to think of the last movie I saw that was nameless, that had a nameless character, because it was all over the place back then. And it just created something that made people our age think, wow, that's the coolest shit in the world.
Yeah, I mean, we're going to talk about a few more further on. That are like, just like that. I mean, The Road literally has the man and the boy as the characters.
That's true, yeah.
But yeah, I mean, it's something that comes up. It's a trope that comes up a lot, and it'll be interesting to see when it kind of makes another resurgence in filmmaking.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm curious. I'm curious how that's going to go. I mean, I'm very curious how the next 10 years in general are going to go for film, because we're seeing a lot of changes, but we're also seeing a lot of box office disasters with those changes. And you wonder at some point, what's Hollywood going to do? Money or social? How do you find the middle ground there? How do you get it to like the point that they actually want it to be, rather than just being like, well, we just made this movie and it was a bomb. It's going to be interesting to see how these next 10 years go, because, you know, There's a lot of changes happening in Hollywood, and a movie like Drive probably wouldn't get made many eras. It was very much a movie of the late 2000s, early 2010s.
It very much was.
And Nicholas Winding Refn himself is just an actor or a director who is very much of that era too. That's probably why we don't really see much from him anymore. All right. Well, that's what I got on this movie, John. I don't know if you have anything else you want to say on Drive, or if we should move on.
Nope.
All right. Nope, cool.
That's all I got.
So that's it. That's it for this week's episodes. Next week, we finally talk about my top 100 again. We're going Silence of the Lambs and A Clockwork Orange. So we got a nice, dark, creepy ass week for you ahead. That's a violent week. This one should come with a definite warning for anybody who hasn't seen those movies. Clockwork Orange was rated X at the time it was made. And, you know, the Silence of the Lambs features Hannibal Lecter, who eats people. So pretty wild duo we have next week, which is then followed by Seven and A Single Man. And those movies couldn't be any further apart from each other if we tried. So that's it. We'll see you all next week. Follow us on Letterboxd. I'm watching a lot less movies this year. John's still kind of keeping up. Probably late next week. We'll talk about it afterwards. So keep an eye out for that. And that's it. Bye, everyone.
Bye.